thought for the day. The fear of death is more to be dreaded than death itself.
Welcome to the Regimental Vox, a podcast dedicated to all things Warhammer and wargaming in general. I am your host and Vox operator for the evening, Caleb Meyer. It is Monday, June 29th, 2020, so we are almost over halfway through this entirely awful, shitty year. This is episode 70. Let's just go ahead and get into things here to start. I do want to make a note that I am using a different set of headphones. Any of you who follow the Facebook page may have seen pictures of me using these new headphones. My previous really super nice ones snapped, to be perfectly honest. I'd had them for many years and stuff, so it wasn't entirely surprising. They were really beyond fixing, unfortunately. And I just haven't gotten an opportunity to get a nicer headset yet. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I have noticed that the cups on this do not keep sound in as well. So when I'm up against the microphone and stuff, you may possibly hear some little bits in the background and whatnot. Even though I've got like sound turned off on my phone and so on and so forth. You might hear if I get a notification on the computer or something starts playing in the background on the computer or whatever, that it's going to come through the microphone. So just as a little heads up, I know most people won't really care, but I just figured I should go ahead and throw that out there. So let's go ahead and get into things, though, as far as what's going on in my neck of the woods since the last episode was recorded. Not a whole lot of shit, to be perfectly honest. It's been an extremely busy couple weeks. This past week, having to move a bunch of furniture around and stuff like that. We got a bunch of new furniture here in the house. Well, new to us. Her parents moved, or are moving, rather, and we got a bunch of free shit in the process, which is cool. It kind of put a whole lot of, pressure on getting things done in a quick and timely manner. And on top of that, both of us had our vehicles kind of in need of some repairs and so on and so forth. So it's just been a very, very, very busy week. Like I said, nothing really has gone down. I haven't really had much time for gaming and or the actual building and hobbying factors and stuff. So it's like I said, it's been a week. So hopefully soon that will start slowing down and whatnot. But as of right now, we still got a lot of other things in the pipe. So let's go ahead and just get into some newsy news stuff before we get into the meat and potatoes section here and stuff. For starters, as far as things that are available from good old GW, Pariah, the last chapter in the Psychic Awakening series, is available for pre-order now. Once again, like we kind of talked about in the last episode, it seems like, honestly, like Necron fans are going to probably be pretty damn disappointed with Psychic Awakening, but keep in mind that we are looking at them being part of the new box set, the Indomitus box set, which suggests that they're probably going to be one of the first one of the first factions that will be getting a 9th edition codex. So keep that in mind, take it with a grain of salt that they don't have anything right now coming out with Psychic Awakening, just because they are so most likely so close to getting a codex. It's entirely possible that they'll actually be the first. It's also entirely possible that Space Marines will get yet another codex, even after having one released last year first. I'm really hoping that GW doesn't pull that one, just because it's going to create some feel-badsies. I get why they have to do these things, and personally, I would still rather have a codex that has everything updated in it, rather than having my 8th edition codex plus having to have some supplementary books or whatever just to have my data sheets for my new Space Marine stuff and whatnot. So, like I said, just keep in mind they could do that, but, you know, it's entirely up to you how you feel about that. That being said, there were a few things that we did not cover in the last episode that we're going to cover today as far as changes with 9th edition. And the way GW is handling codex updates and stuff like that is part of that. So, but we will get into that in a bit. But yeah, so you do have the Pariah book that's available for pre-order, as well as the Lord Inquisitor Kyria Draxus. Personally, I'm not crazy about this model at all. It's just an model to me personally. I'm glad to see more, you know, diversity, more female characters and stuff like that coming out. But this one is just, it's just kind of awkward looking to me. I was going to say it looks kind of bland, and to some degree it does. The pose and stuff is rather, it's just a weird looking model. She's wearing some sort of weird, you know, archaic power armor set thing that she's got a random alien skull for a shoulder. She's got a weird bird lizard thing on her power fist, carrying this shuriken pistol around her custom one and stuff. So I mean, it makes sense from, like, you know, the standpoint of being an Ordo Xenos Inquisitor that she's gonna have some alien tech and stuff like that, especially she's described as a radical. It also just still seems a little blah. I don't know. Like, I just feel, I always think of Inquisitors as, you know, imposing figures and stuff, and this one just doesn't scream that to me. But, you know, to each their own. That being said, they're also doing pre-orders on the Illuminor Zaris model, the new one, and my goodness, this guy is an absolute beast. It's kind of interesting that dichotomy there of GW putting out one of their more, not worst models by any stretch, but in my opinion, more bland models alongside probably their best model ever. I mean, honestly, it's such a fucking badass model. Whether you're a big fan of Necrons or not, it looks just like an absolute hobby treat. To, you know, build and paint. It looks like it's going to be a pain in the ass, admittedly, to build and paint. So when I say hobby treat, I should say more hobby challenge is probably a better word, but in a good way. If you have not checked out the new Illuminor Zaris model, holy shit, it is fantastic. I love the old one too, don't get me wrong. When I was working on a Necron Force many a year ago, I really wanted to add Illuminor Zaris to my army, but just use them just as a regular cryptech. I did not, you know, foresee myself really wanting to use his rules as they were. Maybe, maybe not. He just was such a badass model. I thought this would be a perfect stand-in for just any of my normal cryptex in my army. So this new model, though, holy shit, like, it is really badass. So like I said, definitely give that a look over. It's not the cheapest model, it's $50, but that's because he does appear to be fairly large too. So even though he's a character model, he is quite the big one, so keep that in mind. They're also releasing the Ephriel Stern and Keeganil models as well, with the Pariah release, and they're pretty cool looking models. I haven't really seen much on their rules, a little bit here or there, but they're pretty cool looking. I personally, as far as like limited edition, you know, models go or things of that nature, I'm a bigger fan of that Sisters of Battle model. I can't even think of the name of it. I want to say it was like Tatiana something or other. I'm going to try and see if I can look it up. I could be completely off base. Here we go. Tariana. I was close. Tariana Palos. I think that model looks far more badass than the Ephriel Stern model, personally. But, you know, once again, to each their own. But yeah, so, like I said, Pariah is finishing up the Psychic Awakening series in time for 9th edition. Now, speaking of Ephriel Stern, they are re-releasing, and forgive me if I'm mispronouncing this, Demonifuge. I think it's Demonifuge. But yeah, they're releasing this old graphic novel in a 20th anniversary edition. It is $40 for that, but I mean, it's a really nice, you know, hardback and fully colorized graphic novel, so on and so forth. So definitely looks like it is worth its weight in gold there, so to speak. They also have the limited edition version as well. This limited edition version, I don't know if it's still available for pre-order, if it's already sold out. But it's pretty expensive. It's $150. And I mean, it does look cool. It really does. But I'm honestly disappointed that it doesn't include the model on top of it all. It's got some cool dice, some cool collectible pieces, some pins, so on and so forth. I would say, you know, if you're a really big collector, really into Sisters of Battle specifically, sure, you know, why not? But otherwise, I don't know. It just, once again, doesn't wow me by any stretch. So that's just a personal thing. They also are releasing the CD version of Broken Saints. If you haven't had the opportunity to listen to the audio drama Broken Saints, it is a very good one. It's pretty cheap on Audible. So, you know, if you would prefer to just stream it and download it or whatever else, that's an option there too. And it is already available as opposed to pre-ordering a CD version. So, let's see here. What else we got here in newsy news? Oh, yes. So, we got the new Marvel Warhammer crossover dealio. They revealed the cover art as well as the title. It looks like it's going to be Marnius Khalgar. So, yes, the Ultramarines are getting a comic book. I don't know. I've never been a huge comic fan in general, so, you know, for me, it doesn't necessarily blow my mind. That being said, you know, I was just talking about Demonifuge there. I've read a little bit of that many years ago. I think when it was, part of Inferno, if I remember correctly. I had gotten a copy of it. I feel like it was included for free with something else I had bought. I don't remember exactly. It was pretty cool, you know. So I reserve judgment for when we finally get our hands on this comic book and stuff. But once again, it's not something that personally makes me, you know, pee my pants. Particularly since it's Marnius Khalgar and stuff. I understand why GW goes this route and why this is their focus and so on and so forth. Space Marines, particularly Ultramarines, are their bread and butter for their money making. But it still just, I don't know, doesn't make me pee my pants. So it is what it is. So, but yeah, and then, oh, one last thing. I was just about to, you know, take a break and move on to the next section after that, but I did almost forget one other thing I wanted to discuss. They did just announce, this was yesterday, yes, the 28th, the General's Handbook for 2020 for Age of Sigmar, which will include the Warlord Edition that will be available as well. It is going to actually include... where did that go? So there's going to be balance adjustments and stuff like that as usual. But they're also going to have sky battles. So I'm wondering if that's kind of tied into like the rule sets they had in the Aether War box set. They're also going to be able to create your own heroes, which Chapter Approved for 40K had something similar and it was kind of blah. But, you know, there's some potential there. Admittedly, Age of Sigmar is more hero-focused anyway, so those rules might be more fleshed out or at least be more compatible with the game system itself. And they also are going to have rule sets for multiplayer gaming. So, yeah, more than two players, too. So, sounds like some pretty cool stuff we'll be seeing here soon. They are going to have some, you know, updates and previews throughout the week, it looks like. So, I will probably have some new information on that next week, I would guess. So, but I think that is all the things I wanted to cover right now for the up-and-coming Who's and What's It's before we get into Meat and Potatoes, which is going to be a two-part dealio. So, anywho, I'm going to take a quick break. When I come back, we're going to go over some stuff here, some of the things that I missed in 9th edition, and have a little bit of a discussion of on a conversation that I had with some people on Facebook through my local gaming group. Regarding gatekeeping and things of that nature. So, but anyway, you know, stick around. I will be back right after the break.
You're listening to The Regimental Vox. Follow The Regimental Vox on social media by going to facebook.com/TheRegimentalVoxPodcast or on Twitter @RegimentalVox. Like what you're hearing? You can help support the show for as little as $1 a month by going to patreon.com/TheRegimentalVox today.
Welcome back to The Regimental Vox. As mentioned before the break, I wanted to cover a few things that I missed last week when I was doing my 9th edition preview roundup thing. Now, mind you, I knew there was going to be some new stuff that would come out here or there anyway, so there would be more stuff, but I missed a few things that were actually big things that I just, for whatever reason, didn't have open on my tabs there and stuff. Basically, usually for my notes, I have a bunch of tabs open, and I just kind of, as I go through them, click them out and stuff like that, so I know what's where and blah, 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 you know. And sometimes there's stuff that I, you know, thought I opened, but accidentally clicked on a wrong link or whatever else. So, you know, mistakes happen. So this isn't exactly the most professional podcast on earth. In case it wasn't, you know, obvious. Fuck, shit. You know, very unprofessional. Yeah, so I did want to cover a few new things, as well as cover a few things that I had meant to include last week. But yeah, let's go ahead and get into some of this 9th edition Who's and What's It. The big one that I missed last week, we'll start there, was the updates to vehicles and to blast weapons. They are kind of important. They kind of tie together to each other. But yeah, for those who haven't been following or whatever else there, with the vehicles thing, they've got a new rule, big guns never tire. A vehicle or monster, those are included too, a vehicle or monster model can make attacks with ranged weapons even when its unit is within engagement range of enemy units. Which, engagement range is just their new terminology for somebody's up in your shit. You're under attack with an assault and stuff, so. But yes, so you can fire your weapon still if you're a vehicle or a monster. It can only make such attacks against enemy units that are within engagement range, though, it does say. In such circumstances, vehicle and monster models can target an enemy unit, even if other friendly units are within engagement range of the same enemy unit. There's a lot of back and forth there, but basically you can target stuff that's not within engagement range, if you want. I think that's what is, in such circumstances, vehicle can target an enemy unit, even if other friendly units are within engagement range of the same. Oh, okay. Nope. That's saying that even if there's another unit, I misread that at first, even if there's another unit of yours that's also in engagement range, whereas normally you can't fire into a combat, you can in this case. Note that if a vehicle or monster unit has more than one ranged weapon, you can still choose to target units that are not within engagement range of the firing model's unit. However, they will only be able to make the attacks with that weapon if all enemy units within engagement range of the firing model's units have been destroyed when you come to resolve those attacks. In addition, when a vehicle or monster model shoots a heavy weapon, subtract 1 from the hit rolls when resolving that weapon's attacks while any enemy units are within engagement range of that model's unit. Okay, so let's break this down here. For starters, you could still fire even if somebody else is up in your shit. So that's a good plus. The most common problem with vehicles typically in 8th edition was they would get bogged down by stupid shit. You know, somebody's whole block of grots would just suddenly make your layman rust totally useless. And that would be annoying. You know, I had, I think it was my first league game last year. I think it was the first game or one of my first games. I don't remember exactly, but it was early on in the Escalation League. And I found myself, I think my second game, I found myself having Tau drones getting into assault with my Doomcrawler, and neither the drones nor the Doomcrawler could do much to each other. I just had to either sit there and let the drones just keep being a bitch to me, or fall back, can't shoot, then the drones would just, if they weren't dead by the end of that turn, they would just rinse and repeat. Major pain in the ass. So this is a very nice plus. Really helps vehicles out with a major weakness that it was just kind of silly. I understand you need to have counters, and, you know, cheap infantry swarming some big expensive unit is a good counter, but making it impossible for that big expensive unit to do anything about it is just unacceptable. Then also, too, there's that addition there of being able to, normally you can't fire into a combat. If somebody else is, you know, in an assault with one of your units, you can't fire at that target then. This does permit you to do so if it's the same unit that is in your engagement range. So you can't fire into a combat you're not a part of, but you can do so at a separate combat. So that's a plus. And then lastly, you can actually target units that are not in engagement range with you, but the catch is that you must kill everybody that you're in engagement range with first. So for example, let's say you got, you know, you got some big vehicle and you fire off all of your sponsons and crap, heavy bolters, whatever, your anti-infantry crap. So you decide you're going to fire all that shit at point-blank range at the guys that are swarming you. And then you're also going to fire your battle cannon or whatever. We'll say you're a layman rust. You fire your battle cannon at a, you know, at an enemy target further away, you know. And so you go ahead, you roll up the dice. If you manage to smoke all 10 of the enemies that, or however many enemies are surrounding you, I didn't really specify in this scenario, but let's just say you fire 10 shots at 10 models and you manage to smoke them all. Now you get to go ahead and roll for your battle cannon. Now let's say you, on the other hand, you fire all 10 shots and you kill 9 out of 10. And you still have one guy in engagement range with you after that's all said and done. That blast cannon shot, total wash. You don't get to roll it. You don't get to shoot it. It's just, nope, doesn't happen because you chose a different target. Also, too, you could say, all right, I got one guy who's in engagement range. I'm just going to fire one weapon at him. I'm going to unload with everything else on all these other targets. But then you roll off and you don't manage to kill the one dude. All those other weapons that you chose to fire elsewhere don't do anything. You just don't even bother rolling. And then once again, you do have to subtract one from the hit rolls when you're firing a heavy weapon while doing so, which makes sense. You're a little distracted, a little surrounded, so on and so forth. So it's kind of a pain in the ass. So then there's also a new rule for firing heavy weapons on the move. And it does specify when an infantry model shoots a heavy weapon, subtract one from the hit rolls when resolving that weapon's attack, if the firing model's unit has moved for any reason this turn. Main difference there is it's infantry model specifically. Vehicle models no longer are affected by moving and firing. This is a huge boon that I don't know why it took as long as it did to get there, but either way, we're finally here. So, on a random side note, the article I'm reading does have a, what is it, the Inferno Razorback or whatever, the Blood Angels fancy one or whatever with the giant fire cannon thing. I don't remember the name of it, admittedly. But man, it's got a really jacked up pintle mounted storm bolter that is looking pretty poorly built. But oh well, it is what it is. So, all right. So definitely some big changes there, as you can see. But there are some other changes that tie into that. Other changes? I don't know what older is, but other changes is what I meant to say. There are some other changes that definitely affect the way this is going to work even further. Namely, the changes to blast weapons. Many of these changes in blast weapons make them far more capable and powerful than they were before, with the catch being that you cannot use them to fire against units in engagement range. So if you, if you have a dedicated artillery unit, for example, that has nothing else, has no backup close range weaponry or anything like that, you're not going to be able to just unleash an Earthshaker cannon at point blank range at somebody who's up in, up in your face there. So, which makes perfect sense. You're not going to go ahead and do that. Admittedly, let's see here. That is in. Okay. So, admittedly, I don't know if it prevents you from doing that whole. Well, yeah, okay, it does. I was just going to say, I don't know if it prevents you from shooting into another unit that is engaged, but it would, because you can only fire at a unit that is currently engaged with another unit if that same unit... All right, we're going to back it up a little bit. I'm going to set it up a little bit more in a scenario explanation. So let's say you've got your, Basilisk, and you've got a squad of, Astra Militarum infantry, and then Khorne Berserkers are up in your grill, and they're in engagement range with both the Basilisk and the infantry. If you got like the hull mounted heavy bolter, you could fire that at the Khorne Berserkers, but you can't fire the Earthshaker cannon, because even though there is the one rule that says you can totally fire into a combat that with your other unit as long as you're in engagement range with that. So you can fire at the Berserkers as long as they're in engagement with those infantry. You still can't fire the blast weapon either way. So that does prevent that from happening. It even says here firing high explosives at point blank range is simply unwise. Which is true, so I wouldn't recommend it. But what you can do with blast weapons now, they have some extra rules here. If a blast weapon targets a unit that has between 6 and 10 models, it always makes a minimum of 3 attacks. They give an example here. You see you have a D6 weapon with the blast rule, and you fire it at a unit that has 6 or more models, and say you roll a 2, you still get to count it as a 3. So at minimum, you're getting 3 attacks. If a blast weapon targets a unit that has 11 or more models, do not roll the dice at all to randomly determine how many attacks are made. So, for example, if you fire a D6 weapon with the blast rule, targets a unit that has 11 or more models, you just get 6 attacks. Boom, done. So, yeah, this is a very powerful anti-horde weapon, for sure. Which makes sense. The blast weapons should be kind of more meant to, blow holes in large, grouped infantry and stuff. That's kind of the point to a degree. You'll still use, if you're still firing at a tank or a smaller infantry squad or something, you're still going to have to roll and stick with the roll. If you're firing it into large swaths of infantry, you're going to be doing a hell of a lot more damage than you used to. Now, that's not to say that every weapon that has a randomized damage type or randomized, attack amount, that doesn't mean that all of them are going to do that, have this effect. It's only going to be specifically on blast weapons. So if something is, more of like a super fancy laser or something like that, it might be a blast weapon still in the end. But GW kind of has this ability to write a weapon to have a random amount of attacks. But if it's a blast weapon, it's got this extra boost to it. So, but keeping in mind that having it be a blast weapon does mean that it is no good for firing at point blank range. So if you are surrounded and all you have are blast weapons, you're kind of fucked there. But that's kind of the point. So this is you know, having these rules as they are written gives you, as say you have this blast weapon, it's an artillery piece, it gives you an option to counter hordes, but the hordes have an automatic counter against you in that if they swarm you and all you have is your blast weapon, then you're kind of fucked. You end up getting bogged down and everything else then. So, but yeah, so those were the things that I had missed before. As far as new 9th edition stuff that we have not covered yet, I did want to, well, some of it is related to things we did cover, namely Overwatch. So last week we talked about the new Overwatch rules, and the initial preview that they had even did specify that with these new rules, you know, they were like, no worries, Tau, you get to still do the greater good thing, but it's still going to be more limiting, you know? Yeah, you'll still have to spend the CP, but you'll still get some extra boost out of it because more dudes can still be involved. You spend one CP, use greater good, and you have multiple units being able to fire. Unfortunately, they did end up, you know, basically backpedaling on that statement a few days ago when they did the faction focus for the Tau Empire. And now they're saying in this new faction focus that the Tau, don't have to spend the CP for the Overwatch thing. That greater good is totally still in effect, in full. This I feel like is kind of a mistake overall. On the one hand, there's some question as to whether GW made a mistake. I guess I should say, yeah, rather, did they make a mistake when they wrote the original article about Overwatch? That was like, hey, if you're going to be, you know, Overwatch, no worries. Tau still get to use the greater good thing, but you're kind of limited in it. Let me see if I can actually pull up the original thing that mentions Tau specifically. I wouldn't be surprised if they edited it. Yeah, no, I'm not seeing the initial thing that had mentioned anything about it. But I swear that there was something that had said, oh, poor Tau, you know, now you get stuck having to do this whole thing. You know what, right here. You may find that some units benefit from other special rules that modify Overwatch as well, such as the Tau Empire's For the Greater Good special rule. One of our favorite new ones is a battle trait your units can receive as part of a Crusade Force, permanently granting them free and improved Overwatch. Now I'm curious, because I'm trying to remember if I'm having a weird Mandela effect situation of thinking I saw something I didn't, or if they did legitimately change this. I don't remember. But the way things made it sound before was that Tau can spend the 1 CP to use Overwatch still, and you can still use For the Greater Good, but because you spent that stratagem to do it, you only still get to do it once. In a turn, whereas now it's like, nope, there's going to be free Overwatch for everyone, the Tau don't have to spend CP to do Overwatch, so on and so forth. I do feel like having factions, having rules that override the universal rules here or there is fine, you know, but when it's a universal rule that was written specifically to counter how powerful certain options were, and then you write a new rule to counter that new thing, and just so you can retain the status quo, so to speak, that seems a little silly. And like I said, I swear there was wording about it being like, you know, Tau have to spend the 1 CP to do Overwatch, they can still fire off greater good, but that's it then, and now I'm not seeing that. So whether that was initially a mistake that was printed, and then this was the intent to actually not have Tau pay the CP and stuff, or they got enough backlash that it only took them a few days to say, you know what, yeah, we can't do that. We're going to have to backpedal on that initial statement and make it sound like that was the intent. It's hard to say. And once again, I could be having some weird Mandela effect thing where I'm remembering something that just isn't true. I don't know. So, But either way, I'm not sure how I feel about this entirely. It just feels weird, and not good overall. Now, that being said, Overwatch is generally something that I think is more overrated than people, you know, give it credit for, really. It's typically hitting on sixes, and you're typically kind of limited in the amount of units doing it. Now, mind you, Tau, that's kind of their whole shtick is, well, we can just override that limit of amount of units doing it and just pour out a shit ton of fire, basically getting a second shooting phase if we have our line set up appropriately. But still, it seems just a little... I don't know. We'll have to see. Obviously, in practice, that will kind of change the way that things will likely feel to everybody else and stuff. We can sit here theorizing all day how it's going to change things, only to find out, that doesn't really actually change much of anything at all, you know? So, yeah, time will tell. But let's go ahead and move on here to some other goodies with the new announcements and whatnot. They did have, with the Astra Militarum faction focus, they did have some new information regarding the morale phase. So they're going to have this new thing for combat attrition, and the process of the morale test starts the same way as before. For morale test, you roll a d6, add the number of models destroyed this turn. Unmodified roll of 1 is always a success, and if the morale test exceeds the unit's leadership, one model automatically flees, and then you take a combat attrition test on top of it. So the difference here is that combat attrition test. What you will do is you will now roll 1d6 for each remaining model in the unit. For each one additional model flees. Subtract 1 from combat attrition tests if unit is below half strength. So, for example, say you got your squad of, you know, guard infantry again, and, you know, they take a bunch of hits, and now they're down to, like, 7 dudes. And they go ahead, they take a morale test, roll a d6, and I think their leadership is normally 7. So we'll even just say they roll a 6. So 6 plus the 3 dudes they lost is a 9. That obviously beats their leadership. Now, what's going to happen, though, is instead of before, you would go, okay, well, then 2 guys run. You know, 9 minus my leadership of 7 leaves me with 2. 2 guys run. Now, instead, one dude's going to run, and then for the remaining 6 guys that are still there, you're going to have to roll a d6 on top of for each individual one. And say you roll 4 ones, 4 more guys bolt. You might roll no ones at all. Nobody runs, you know. So it's going to add a little bit more randomness to the effects of morale. And I do like this idea. I do feel like, even though there's a lot of things in 9th that are kind of being written to speed up the game a little bit more, since 8th edition, the goal was to speed up the game, and in some ways it did, and in other ways it totally fucking failed miserably to speed up the game. This, I feel like, is definitely adding another layer of rolls and re-rolls and things of that nature that is slowing shit down. That being said, I do like the idea overall, personally. I think it's going to make that morale check have a little bit more oomph to it, a little more value. If you're at risk of losing an entire squad because of a failed leadership test, that's definitely going to make you want to work harder to have things to boost morale, to counter the loss in morale and stuff like that. Because right now, the morale phase, there's a lot of ways that you can kind of circumvent things enough that it's just a non-issue altogether. Also, too, there are ways you can stack a bunch of shit so dudes just run and flee left, right, and sideways. This kind of helps you come up with ways to kind of rein it in a little bit, I guess. So, that being said, too, another thing they have pointed out with 9th edition is that they are going to do hard limits on modifiers. I bring that up now because I talk about morale tests. Like, if you say you build like a Night Lord's army and you totally tool it out, specifically for morale damage, there was all sorts of crazy ways that you could just basically kill one dude and have a whole squad, or at least a huge portion of it, end up fleeing the field in the process, because of all the modifiers and things of that nature. Modifiers will now be hard capped at a +1 or a -1. This, for me personally, is probably the most controversial thing that I've seen so far with the 9th edition. Once again, personally, I am extremely torn on this. On the one hand, it is severely frustrating and infuriating to have a model that normally hits on a 2, for example, my Doom Crawlers, they normally hit on 3s, but there were ways I could amp it up or whatever, but we'll just go ahead and say you're hitting on a 3 typically. And you got this weapon that it has a randomized number of shots, D3 shots, and it does D6 damage with a minimum damage of 3. Very, very, very powerful weapon, the neutron laser on the Doom Crawler. But you would have these situations where, all right, I got this super tricked out dude. I spend some CP, so he's now hitting on 2s. But then my enemy, particularly like Eldar or Dark Eldar, Eldari and Drukhari, that they would have hard to hit because it's a flyer, and then they're spending like a CP on lightning reflexes, and they got this and they got that. So now my 2+ hit is now like a 5+ or some dumb shit like that. It's severely nasty. You can have this whole unit basically become useless most of the game because the enemy is going to just spend CP at countering it time and time and time and time again. Now you're not going to be able to stack all this stuff. Now the advantage there is that this gives most units at least a little bit of a fighting chance to hit those harder to hit targets and things of that nature. But what it also does is it provides less interaction for different models between terrain, CP, and so on and so forth. If somebody's already hard to hit because they're already a flyer, they're not going to be spending CP to do this or do that or whatever else. They're just already hard to hit, so they don't give a fuck. Now I don't know if that's there might be, actually, I would say it's entirely possible that maybe if somebody, say for example, my Doom Crawler again, I spend CP, so I'm hitting on a 2+ instead of a 3+, but the enemy's already got a -1 modifier. I don't know if those modifiers then cancel each other out, so it counts as 0, and therefore each player, if they have some other ability, like the lightning reflexes for Eldari and Drukhari and stuff, or whatever else that I might have for my Doom Crawler, I don't know if then you'll be able to say, all right, well, this guy's got a -3 to hit modifier in total because he spent all this CP and crap. I've got a +2 modifier, so it's still a -1. By stacking multiple things, and that's the key there, I should say too, that I don't get +2 because of one thing. I get +2 because I've spent a CP and I've got some, aura ability in range too. I don't know if that still counts just as the +1 overall, and therefore between my +1 and their -1 due to all their crap, if that's just going to even out to 0, or if I can say, all right, I'm in this aura range, so now I'm hitting on a 2, and they go, well, I'm hard to hit, so you're still hitting on a 3. And then I could go, okay, well, I'm going to spend CP to make it a 2 again. Then they're going to go, okay, I'm going to spend CP for lightning reflexes, so it's still back to a 3. I don't know how that's going to stack out overall. And also, too, can you then go, all right, well, now it's at a 3, but I've also got an aura ability, so now it's actually a 4+ to hit instead. I once again, I don't entirely know how that's going to pan out. We'll have to see when we have the actual rules if modifiers will stack multiple times and then be capped off or not. Admittedly, I'm not seeing the specific thing. There might be something listed with the cap modifiers that I'm just not seeing right now in my notes that I might have missed or something along those lines. But either way, you know, there are, like I said, there are options possible there to take care of that. So, all right, moving on here. They've also showed off some new stuff with strategic reserves. This is kind of interesting, an interesting change to reserves. Strategic reserves are going to cost command points. Now, I, once again, I'm not sure. Let's see here. It's worth pointing out at this. It's worth pointing out that at this stage, if your units have abilities that enable them to set up somewhere other than the battlefield, such as, you know, teleport strike ability of Terminators, cult ambush for Gene Stealer cults, etc., then these rules don't apply to them. So this is to allow you to use units that don't typically have their own inbuilt rule that circumvents normal deployment. This gives you an option to spend CP towards putting those units into reserve all the same and having them do fancy battlefield deep strike drops and things of that nature. All right, so the way this is going to work, you take the combined power rating of your units that you're putting into strategic reserve. Once again, not any models that have deep strike or whatever already built into them. Units that don't is the key. You combine the power rating, and that will tell you how many CPs it costs to place them into strategic reserves. So 1 to 9 is 1, and then it goes up by 10 each time, 10 to 19, 20 to 29, etc., etc. And it's 1, 2, 3, etc., etc., as far as CP. So this will give you, if you want to put a whole shit ton of your army into strategic reserve, go for it. But it's going to cost you the CP to do it all. So then on top of that, they cannot arrive until the second battle round at the earliest. And so you may find yourself turn one just having too much to deal with and getting smoked off the table too quickly. And there's an interesting way that you can, on how you set them up, too. So battle round one, there's no strategic reserves allowed to come into play. Battle round two, you can set up wholly within 6 inches of any battlefield edge, but not the enemy's battlefield edge or in their deployment zone. And then battle round three and higher, you can set up wholly within 6 inches of any battlefield edge, not enemy battlefield edge. So, yeah, and then also on top of that, you cannot be set up within 9 inches of enemy models. They cannot make a normal move, advance, or fall back in the same turn that they come on the board. And they also always count as having moved, probably for purposes of firing weapons and stuff. And then it's no longer by the end of the third turn having to be set up. It's just set up by the end of the battle. If they are not set up by the end of the battle, they are destroyed. So that's a pretty nice boost overall. It's going to provide a lot of extra flexibility for armies that don't have a whole lot of deep strike models and stuff. And it's going to allow you to kind of have a more tactical approach to things. You know, do I come in on turn two with these models, or do I wait until turn three so I can also be in my enemy's deployment zone and such? So There's definitely a lot of potential for some crazy options there. So, and plus, it also will force players to make sure to do better about screening. You know, if the enemy can come in on turn three in your deployment zone, even you want to make sure that you have have all of your deployment zone edges covered. Within that 9-inch bubble, basically. So make sure you pay attention to that. Otherwise, you may find some random unit outflanking you. I think it's a pretty cool addition overall, though. So, and then let's see here. They've also added some information regarding missions and stuff. They gave an example for combat patrol. I think there's a lot of cool stuff going on here, too. They showed off a mission called Incisive Attack. What's cool is you're going to include not only special mission rules that change the way the specific missions work, but they're going to have different objectives, both primary and secondary objectives. Plus, with the new changes on how battlefield sizes work, that they're built on minimums as opposed to specific sizes, you know, that the traditional 6x4 and stuff, that it, or 4x6, depending on who you ask, that now it's going to be, all right, this type of battle is a minimum size this. And so you got that deployment map that's going to show you where the center of the field is and then how to measure out from that to determine where your deployment zones are at and stuff. It's going to provide a lot more flexibility for playing in different size spaces, whether you're on a dining room table, your floor, you know, cafeteria table at work, on your lunch break, whatever. You're going to have a lot more options. So I'm really excited to check out more of this. I'm really excited about the fact that they are doing these different size games too, and having actual rules that are scaled and changed and specific missions for those specific game sizes. I think that's going to also be very useful to people who run leagues and stuff. It's going to give you a better tool set, to more appropriately, especially like an escalation league, since you start off with smaller sizes and work your way up to larger size battles. It's going to afford you some extra flexibility in terms of you not having to spend as much time making your own missions that are fun and stuff, that based on the size of the mission itself. You're already going to have kind of like templates to work from. So definitely very, very cool stuff there. But yeah, oh, and then lastly, there's some new stuff that actually popped up. I saw when I was on my break, they have the new faction focus for Gene Stealer Cults. And they added a few specific, rules here. They do have some rules regarding, and this is the first time I'm actually reading this stuff, so bear with me here. Some rules regarding a progressive and end game objective here. Let's see here. So they have this one, raise the banners high. This is because you actually get to choose your own objectives and stuff in some mission types. If you select this objective, then units in your army can perform the following action. Raise banners. One or more infantry units from your army can start to perform this action at the end of your movement phase. Each unit from your army that starts to perform this action must be in range of a different objective marker that does not have one of your banners raised upon it. A unit cannot start this action while there are any enemy units, excluding aircraft, in range of the same objective marker. The action is completed at the end of your turn. If this action is successfully completed, that objective marker is said to have one of your army's banners raised on it. And the banner is removed if your opponent controls the objective marker at the start of any phase. You score one victory point at the end of each of your command phases and one victory point at the end of the battle for each objective marker on the battlefield that has one of your banners raised upon it. So, you know, just adding some extra flair and stuff there to kind of provide you options for your own gameplay styles and stuff. Some missions I think are still going to have very specific, this is what you got to do, and other ones are going to be, all right, you choose your objectives, which gives you flexibility based on your play style and stuff, and it's going to force your enemy to have to go, all right, this is their objective, this is what they're working towards, I'm going to have to counter that. Pretty cool stuff there. Let's see here. There's a whole bunch of stuff about performing actions. That's just pretty basic stuff overall. There's a bunch of wording to basically say, you know, you can provide an action provided you didn't advance, fall back, enemies within engagement range, etc., etc. So, nothing I'm seeing really jumping out there. Well, actually, it does say, if a unit is destroyed, makes a normal move, advances, falls back, attempts to manifest a psychic power, declares a charge, performs a heroic intervention. Basically, if a unit does anything after it started performing an action, but before it's completed, it has failed. Okay, that makes sense. Now, the one thing I did see that kind of clued me in. I had seen on my Facebook news feed someone had shared this rule about unit coherency. So that made me decide, all right, there's probably some new article here that I haven't seen yet. So unit coherency, a unit that has more than one model must be set up and finish any sort of move as a single group, with all models within 2 inches horizontally and 5 inches vertically of at least one other model from their unit. While they have six or more models, they must instead be within 2 inches horizontally and 5 inches vertically of at least two other models from their unit for coherency purposes. If a unit cannot end any kind of move in coherency, that move cannot be made. The units are primarily moved in the movement phase, but they can also be moved in the charge phase, fight phase, etc. Some rules allow you to add models to a unit during the battle. They must be set up in coherency to the unit they're being added to. And obviously, if you can't fit them in, they're destroyed. So, this is kind of... I'm not quite entirely certain what the goal here is, actually, with this. I did see some people that were like, oh, it's the end of the whole conga line thing, that you're not going to be able to have one guy sitting over way in the backfield holding some objective and having all of his buddies like lined up in such a way where they're just going, you know, all the way out to another objective, or, you know, screening out a whole portion of the battlefield just by stretching everybody out and therefore preventing deep strikes and stuff. It's going to add a little bit to that, but overall, it's not going to take away from it. The example was given, say you have 10 models. In the old way, you'd have to have, you could start with model 1 all the way on the left side, model 10 all the way on the right, and as long as, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, as long as everybody was at least 2 inches from somebody else, you could just have this whole line spread out in a straight line. With the new rules, all that matters is the two ends. You know, that, alright, everybody has to be within 2 inches of two models, so, with, you know, 2 inches horizontally and 5 inches vertically, so... You know, you'd have to either have a weird, like, triangle basically on each end of the line, or you'd have to have, like, a guy directly above the guy on the end of the line, etc. Yeah, and then you can still conga line in between, though, because obviously, you know, take for example, you have one directly above two. And therefore, it's within, they're both within 2 inches horizontally, and you could say that, you know, we'll say that they're within 5 inches vertically of both, that model one is within coherency of both two and three, two and three are within coherency of each other. From there, though, you got number two is 2 inches from number three, 3 inches is from three is 2 inches from number four, and it just keeps going down the line until you get to the other end, and then you got another cluster of them. It seems, at least in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, visually, that does seem to work. So it really doesn't change a damn thing. Unless there's something we are missing here, either because this is part of a greater set of rules that will make more sense, it isn't, you know, that it's just some weird half-assed attempt to prevent conga lines and, you know, screens that just block out everything just by will of spreading out too far. I don't know. It's once again, it's hard to say. Now they do have this new rule, unit coherency check. Each player must now remove models one at a time from any of the units in their armies that are no longer in coherency until only a single group of models from the unit remains in play and in unit coherency. The models removed count as having been destroyed, but they never trigger any rules that are used when a model is destroyed. Models removed because of this do not cause their unit to take another morale test. This is kind of a carryover from Age of Sigmar, and I'm kind of curious to see how it will work in the long run. Because right now, you know, if you got 10 guys stretched out, and for whatever reason the guy in the middle dies, either, you know, due to special weapon that can pick out a specific model or something, and now you got your unit split, well, the next time you go to make a move, you just gotta move them back into coherency. Done deal. Okay. Well, with Age of Sigmar, you can have models, if a unit gets split due to enemies killing specific things or whatever else, that ends up creating the situation, or because also too, if you're not careful in an assault, and you have to, because you have to move closer to the closest enemy model. Well, if you start doing that and you're not paying attention, you accidentally split your unit up in the process, or at least, well, technically you can't if it's going to force them to become incoherent from what they've said in those rules. So you can't actually force it that way. But if you put yourself in a position where the enemy can easily do that for you by killing specific models or whatever, now you find yourself losing entire, you know, groupings of a unit because they're out of coherency, instead of them just going, okay, well, now I got to move back in, you know. So it's going to be more important to pay attention to the way you're moving your models is what it boils down to. So, and lastly, they do have emergency disembarkation. Man, I can't talk for shit today. Is a 1 CP core stratagem. When a transport model from your army is destroyed, all units that are embarked within it can be set up wholly within 6 inches of the destroyed model instead of the normal 3 before it's just removed. They are not affected by the model's explodability. Instead, you just roll 1d6 for each model. Instead of one model that disembarked for each roll of 1, one model that disembarked is destroyed for each roll of 1 or 2. Units cannot declare a charge or perform a heroic intervention the same term that they disembarked from a destroyed transport model. Okay. I'm not entirely certain, like, yeah. Okay, so the point here is that, you know, if your transport gets destroyed while it's surrounded by enemy models, normally, because you couldn't set up your dudes within, you know, the proper range and stuff without automatically being in the fight, they're automatically just wiped out. This new stratagem will allow you to avoid fights and stuff. You can still get the models out and get them away and stuff, but there's an increased odd of them being killed in the process, as opposed to just automatically being killed, though, if they're surrounded. So it's going to be situational. Once again, unless I'm missing something because of a larger set of rules here that we don't have, to my understanding right now, you can ditch out of a transport that's getting blown up and stuff. You're automatically destroyed in the process. Depending on the situation, of course, like I said, but, yeah, it might be useful in certain situations, maybe not as much as it sounds. I don't know. We'll have to see. So, but I think that's it as far as that 9th edition coverage I mentioned. I'm going to take another quick break here. When I come back, we're going to have a little chat about gatekeeping in terms of, you know, new people coming into the hobby and stuff. So, yeah, we'll discuss that when I come back around for the break. So stay tuned.
You're listening to The Regimental Vox. Follow The Regimental Vox on social media by going to facebook.com/TheRegimentalVoxPodcast or on Twitter at Regimental Vox. Like what you're hearing? You can help support the show for as little as $1 a month by going to patreon.com/TheRegimentalVox today.
Welcome back to the Regimental Vox. I mentioned before the break, I wanted to cover one last topic here, but I did want to mention a couple other things here quick, namely some clarification on something I mentioned before the break regarding the unit coherency thing. I was looking around online a little bit during the break just to see if there was something I was missing. And maybe I'm mistaken here, but like with the current rules, you know, the person who's being shot at, or, you know, that is losing models, is going to choose which models to take out of the unit. So it doesn't entirely make sense, I guess, you know, why this unit coherency thing is such a big deal. But I might be missing something, you know, either there's a new ruling, or maybe I just had something fucked up in 8th edition myself this whole time. But I don't quite see the problem there, but kind of, you know, reinforcing what I said before the break, the catch overall is if you have everything, you know, conga lined in such a way, and then somebody snipes out the dude holding up the whole thing right directly in the middle, you end up losing one of the two halves that's left over during the morale phase. So it's something you need to be very careful about if you have enemies that can pick out specific models. But once again, too, if there's something new there, or maybe even something old that I just somehow have fucked up this whole time, by all means, call me out. Let me know, facebook.com/theregimentalvoxpodcast. You can hit me up there, either message me directly or leave a comment and, just share your thoughts on the subject. It's an interesting rule, but it doesn't do much overall outside of sniping and things of that nature. And that might be its whole point, even, is to just discourage people from trying to set up the old daisy chain conga line situation, but not make it so that it's absolutely crippling if you do. I don't know. So there was that I did want to specify. The other thing was, there was actually, once again, another fun little update. This weekend, they're going to be doing another preview, showing off units fighting each other. And that's going to be this Saturday, the 4th, here in the great state of Michigan. That looks like the show is going to start around 8:45. Unfortunately, I will be at work at the time, so I won't be able to watch it live. But they did show off some new rules. I won't go into all of the stuff right now, because we'll probably cover a bunch of stuff related to this on next week's episode. But I did want to mention, with the Eradicators specifically, these Eradicators, they showed off the data sheet. They're going to be guys in the Mark 10 Gravis armor, and they're going to be armed with Melta rifles, which is a new Melta weapon. This seems extremely overpowered, almost to a fault. The Melta rifle itself is a 24-inch range, so it has the range of a multi-Melta, but it is Assault 1. It's an assault weapon, so they can even advance and fire if they wanted to. Strength 8, AP neg 4, D6 damage. When resolving an attack against a unit that's within half range, roll 2d6 and discard one of the results. That is ridiculous. It makes multi-meltas seem silly, even, at least in a Space Marine army. Why bring the multi-melta when you just have this Eradicator squad? Mind you, obviously, with the new vehicle rules and everything, part of it is, well, infantry are meant to be squishier, so I guess. But then they have this total obliteration rule. You can choose in your shooting phase and declare that the unit's only going to fire at one target, a single target. And if you do, they can shoot twice this phase, but they can only target that enemy unit. So rather than split firing between multiple targets, you can just, the box set comes with three of these guys. Don't know if they'll be allowed to be in larger squads or not, right now. But, if all three of them target the same thing, you're talking six Melta shots coming down your throat at the same time. That is bad. That is a crazy amount of firepower. So, they don't show the points value. They are 5 power level. We'll have to see in the long run. Maybe they're going to be prohibitively expensive points-wise and stuff, too. I don't know right now, but there's, like I said, there's some definite potential here for having a mega overpowered unit, so it's kind of important that we keep that in mind with how we approach this whole thing. We'll have to see when we actually have the full rule set, whether they are or are not. So, all right, but let's get into this last part I wanted to cover. The whole gatekeeping thing. If you follow the page, I did share an article last week. I don't remember specifically which day that was right off the top of my head. But it was I'll have a link in the show notes and stuff here. It is an article regarding a woman's experience with going to different stores and trying to get games in. I will not read the article verbatim by any stretch here and stuff. You can, once again, follow the link. It's not too terribly long of an article, but, you know, if I was reading it verbatim, we might be here for a while. And unfortunately, I have to go to work still yet, so, tonight. But, at any rate, the point is she kind of describes some of her experiences of going into different stores. She's both a woman as well as a minority on top of that. And there's been a lot of, you know, conversations around things lately with everything going on in the world regarding specifically minorities and people of color, but it also affects, you know, women too. Now, in my personal experiences, obviously, I as a white male, I don't really run into problems as far as, you know, being cast aside or treated differently and stuff too much, but overall there is something to be said for social anxiety and introverts and so on and so forth. Our hobby tends to be filled with many people who are just socially awkward, introverted, etc. So, you know, there is some tie in there, but I'm by no means comparing the experiences as equivalent in any capacity. Far from it. And that's kind of my point even too with this. She goes on to describe showing up to a store and, then everybody's just kind of ignoring her when she tries to become kind of involved. You know, everybody still kind of ignores her and stuff till finally she speaks up and everyone's just kind of like, well, we don't know how long our game's going to take. Nobody even tries to actually interact with her in any capacity beyond just, you know, she has to engage and gets these really brief, vague responses. And then finally, you know, by the time she gets an opportunity to even join in the games or whatever, everybody's like, we're going to bomb out, you know. Now, mind you, you know, this from the outside looking in and stuff, she could have showed up, you know, they might have been gaming for a while and stuff at this point. You know, it does say in her article that when she finally engaged them, they're like, we just started playing. Whether that was their first round or their 10th round, I have no idea. But the point is that she's trying to get involved and stuff, but she walks into these stores and finds herself basically, you know, ignored. And not just by the gamers, but by the people who run the store and stuff too. This, I feel like, is an important conversation that should be had. And once again, in her case, she's both a woman and a minority, and it just kind of adds, you know, double stacks the negatives against her, so to speak, making it far more difficult for her to get involved and stuff, even though she wants to be. Now, my personal experiences as far as what I've seen in hobby stores and stuff like that, my local area is actually pretty good overall and stuff. It's still primarily white men, but, you know, like when Krista was getting involved into Warhammer and whatnot, finding games to play with people was not that difficult for her overall. You know, she would post on this local gaming group on Facebook, and yeah, she was looking for a game, mentioning she's, you know, new, looking for an introduction, etc., etc. And not really having too many terrible problems with finding people. You know, she wasn't inundated with responses to a point where she had too many people to respond to. But she also wasn't left going, nobody wants to game with me, even though they're all talking about gaming with each other. So my local area has been rather inviting and stuff, for the most part. And then even when she has played games with people, she's very rarely experienced, you know, she hasn't actually mentioned any specific experiences as far as things like mansplaining or whatever else goes. So But I say all that not as a, oh, well, this article's full of shit. No, I'm actually saying it more that my area feels more like an exception to the general rule. I've talked to, I actually got this article originally from a buddy of mine who lives on the other side of the state. And part of the reason he even shared it in the first place was because his area is very problematic in this realm. I feel like our hobby as a whole, and when I say that, I don't just mean Warhammer, but the whole wargaming hobby, or board games in general, you know, the tabletop gaming as a whole, has issues with both sexism and racism, but I feel like it's definitely far more leaning towards sexism-related issues and stuff, at least in my personal experiences. And even, like I said, talking to a few other people from other parts of the state and stuff, that seems to be the case as well. But there's definitely, you know, if you're a dude, there's not too much concern. If you're a dude, you're a dude, and that's that. You know, they don't really seem to, there doesn't seem to really be too many issues overall with, you know, racial issues and stuff there. But the moment a woman walks into the mix, it turns into a whole completely different problem. And this is not to downplay, you know, issues related to racism in the hobby and stuff like that. Far from it. I just overall have experienced from what I've seen and talking to other people, sexism is definitely the bigger problem of the two, and that's going to happen sometimes in different hobbies or different forms of entertainment and stuff. You're going to find that sexism might be more of an issue in this realm, whereas racism is more of an issue in this realm, whereas both are more equal in another realm, and so on and so forth. So the overall point, of course, though, being here is that as a community, we can do better. We can do much better. I did have, you know, I posted this article through my page and then I shared it through some gaming groups, did get some feedback from some people. What surprised me, overall was the amount of pushback that came in terms of social anxiety and introversion, which is part of why I brought that up to begin with. I had several people, that almost kind of seemed to miss the point, I guess, of the article as a whole. Or that, and I'm not like calling them out entirely and stuff, because there was nobody who was like, well, you know, they're not white, so fuck them, I guess. You know, there was none of that type of bullshit. It was just more people getting very defensive about social anxiety and being an introvert and being like, well, I have problems engaging, you know, people in general, so I don't feel like I should be blamed or attacked for not stepping, you know, not standing up, giving this new person who walked in the door a big hug and being like, hey, you know, let's do this, let me kiss your ass and play a game, blah blah blah, you know. And it's like, no, I don't think that's any part of what this article's calling for or desiring in any capacity, for starters. And secondly, like, if anything, I would say that it's once again not equivalent. But if you are an introvert and social, you know, have social awkwardness and anxiety, it can be difficult just going to game in the first place. You know, that was without Krista's support and kind of pushing me last year to finally get off my ass and actually go roll some dice and play some games and get involved in some leagues. I just hadn't really played Warhammer in a long time, you know, and a big part of it was life stuff, but another big part of it was just, new people freak me the fuck out, you know, and having to go places and do things is just overwhelming and scary and stuff. And I know that sounds silly, but I have anxieties and, you know, I am an introvert and a little bit of a shut-in. So, you know, I get that. I totally get that feeling. And I get what people are saying when they're like, I don't think I should be blamed or accused of gatekeeping because I'm an introvert. That's fine. That's totally fine. That's not the point here. You know, the point is not that everybody, every white male who plays the games needs to now suddenly step up and just, you know, invite every single person who walks by into their games. And like I said, just start passing out hugs and so on and so forth. You're still an introvert. You still have social anxiety. And overall, that's just kind of a weird behavior anyways, to jump up and just start touching people that walked in a store. without knowing who they are. But yeah, the whole point being is that if you feel like this is somehow an attack on you, you kind of missed the point. If anything, you should see it more as, man, I've had my own experiences of having issues getting involved in games and stuff in the past because of, you know, not necessarily because of gatekeeping due to race or sexism, but just anxieties and introversion, you know, walking up to a table and having the bravery to even do that in the first place for some people is hard, you know, but somebody still took the time to help you out and get you involved and so on. So you would think that as somebody who was introverted or had social anxiety and had been having feelings of feeling outcast or not being able to get involved or whatever else, you would think you would naturally want to promote something that is wants to support getting more people involved and kind of tearing down these barriers and things of that nature. And also, too, I don't see this as some sort of call that, once again, that every socially awkward, introverted person suddenly needs to change their entire personality, and if not, you're a piece of shit. But no, the fuck no, it's not. You know, if you are totally incapable because your anxieties and stuff make you incapable of doing anything about it, that's fine. That's totally fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You obviously have, you know, you have your own share of issues or problems or whatever else, and I'm not knocking you in any capacity. Once again, I share a lot of those issues myself. But, you know, there's no need to get all pissy and defensive about it either. You know, just simply go, I can't. I'm sorry, but I can't. That's fine. You know, I get it. And I think most people will understand that. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But the point is that if you are capable of being that ambassador, you know, if you are capable of being that voice for the group to open the door and invite someone in for, you know, regardless of whether they are, you know, white male or a woman or person of color or whoever they are, if they come up to your table and they're like, this looks interesting or whatever, or if they're just watching or, you know, especially if they say something themselves. Then engage that person if you can. If you cannot, because of your anxieties, it's okay. You know, nobody is blaming you for that. Nobody's attacking you. It kind of feels like if you take it as an attack, it's almost like, and I'm not saying that it is this case, but it feels like you have a guilty conscience and this is just kind of your cover up for it. Because you get so defensive about something that isn't even about you. You know, so nobody's blaming you for these mistakes or blaming you for gatekeeping or whatever else, you know, so I don't know. Overall, I feel like we could do better as a hobby, you know, the Warhammer community specifically, tabletop gaming as a whole, to just be more welcoming and inviting. Personally, a big part of the reason I do this podcast in the first place and stuff is not just because I like hearing my own voice and just like never shut up about Warhammer, though, you know, that second one is particularly true. But a big part of it is because I want to encourage growth in the community. I want more people to come and play this game. This game is amazing. I love Warhammer. Obviously. I make a fucking podcast. I get paid zero fucking dollars for it. And I take hours out of my week to do this, you know, but I want more and more people involved. The more the fucking merrier, you know, that's kind of the point. You should want more people to play, because I don't want to go back to the days of where you could barely find a goddamn soul anywhere who knew what the fuck you were talking about, let alone actually wanted to play it, you know, but you know, things have changed nowadays with the rise of the internet and social media and so on and so forth that I've, you know, a couple months ago I was at my stepdad's retirement party and a guy saw me wearing my Flying Monkeys Wargaming shirt. And, you know, conversation just started. He didn't know what Warhammer was, but he was familiar with X-Wing. He was asking me questions about X-Wing and I was like, I've dabbled a bit. I don't know much about it. But the point is that I wasn't there to have some big conversation about wargaming. And here's this guy who's like, oh, you know, just some random dude who my stepdad worked with. And we just fired up a conversation and started talking about it. And I was, you know, once again, being this ambassador towards, yeah, by all means, you know, him and his son, they're really unfamiliar with tabletop gaming, but they'd heard about X-Wing. They're big Star Wars fans and wanted to find out more about it. You know, so once again, I didn't know a whole ton, but I turned them towards some, you know, specific groups and stuff in the area that they could talk to, some specific stores that they could visit and talk to people there. You know, I was trying to be an ambassador for the hobby. Now, mind you, once again, in this case, this guy was a white male, but it wouldn't have mattered overall. If I'd been sitting there just going up to the bar at this retirement party to, you know, grab some drinks and some, you know, random woman walked up to me and started asking me about wargaming, I wouldn't have been like, what do you know about games? You're a girl, dude. You know, and stuff. That's stupid. I would have, you know, done the exact same. Been like, all right, let's do this. Let's talk about the hobby. Let's see if you're, you know, let's try to get you into this stuff. Like I said, the more the fucking merrier. So, but yeah, that's just something that's been big on my mind the past week or so. So, especially once again with everything going on. But I did find this article particularly interesting. Once again, I will share a link to it in the show notes for those who are interested. You know, and I will close it out. Just by sharing one last little bit, here from this article, the last paragraph here. So if you're looking for a way to increase diversity, start there. Be the friendly face. It's free, but it's not easy. Don't give up because people don't want to take you up on your offer. What's important is the offer was made. Be active in welcoming others and be sincere. Be a light. And that's kind of the point. Once again, if you are too much of an introvert and you just can't do it, no one's holding that against you. But if you can, you know, if you can and you want to spread this hobby, you want to be an ambassador, if you want more people involved and stuff, and you should want that, just be welcoming, be sincere, and try to invite people in. Simple. You know, it's not simple. Once again, it's not easy. But the overall concept is. So, but I think that's all for this week. So as usual, you can follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/theRegimentalVox podcast, on Twitter @RegimentalVox, and on Patreon, patreon.com/theRegimentalVox. And, you know, make a donation. Every little bit helps. Right now, I think it's a grand total of $0, and that's okay. But, you know, would certainly help me to be able to get better headset, like rather than the janky one I have, and a better setup overall, more hobby supplies to actually have more to share and talk about and stuff. But yeah, thank you guys for listening. I will catch you all in the next episode. This is Caleb Meyer signing out for the evening. Have a wonderful week, everyone.